Like the Sedra of Yisro. Yisro, of course, was the father-in-law of Moses. Moses married the daughters of Yisro. And basically, our general understanding about Yisro is that he was a high-level kind of a person. He was called Kohen On, the Kohen. Kohen is a priest is a bad term, of course, but it means a spiritual leader, you know, so to speak, a person with knowledge of how man should relate to God, basically. How old is man to play? Right.
Does that have to do with Kohen
and reading? Oh, yeah, right, a Kohen.
The Kohen.
Oh, you're a daughter of a Kohen. Then you must marry a Torah scholar. Then you must, or else he'll, whoever you marry will die. Will die young.
Really?
The Finger says you cannot marry anyone else. And it's special to the royalty, but this is our royalty.
That's what I'm saying.
So you have to marry a Torah scholar. Okay, we specialize in that field. You tell us that much about Yisro. And I want to do a little bit on the character of Yisro. Now it says that Yisro heard everything that occurred that God had done for Moses and Israel, that he had taken the Jews out of Egypt. So then he came with Tzipora, who was Moses' wife, after he had separated from her, and that, of course, it was a different kind of a separation, which I'm not going to go right now, and he had some sons, and so on and so forth. So there's a meeting between Yisro and Moshe. Now the rabbis have a whole discussion about what prompted him to come. Eventually, by the way, he converted to Judaism, Yisro. He was on a very high level, great intellectual. So it says later on that Moshe went out. It's particularly in verse 7. You see that Moshe gave tremendous respect to his father-in-law. It shows you, of course, something about the nature of Moshe also, his humbleness, the fact that he was the greatest individual who ever lived or ever will live. Nevertheless, he went out to greet his father-in-law, and he bowed down to him, and he kissed him, and they each asked how the other one was doing, and then they went into the tent. Then Moshe told his father-in-law everything that God had done to Pharaoh and to Mitzrayim concerning the Jews, and all of the weariness that they had encountered on the way, and that God had saved them. So Moshe basically told him over all the events, an insider's perspective. Yisro wanted to know what happened. Now, what was the reaction of Yisro? Take a look at verse 9. It says in Hebrew, Vayichad Yisro. Vayichad Yisro means, in the plain literal meaning is that he rejoiced. Chedva is rejoicing. He rejoiced for all the good that God had done to Israel, that he had saved them from Egypt. Now, first of all, this alone tells you something. If you study the verse carefully, I say that every verse in the Torah is subject to tremendous analysis. I mean, we read through it quickly. We pick up, but every verse tells you an idea. What does it tell you alone about the Yisro? Yisro rejoiced for all the good that God had done to Israel. That tells you something. What? Yes. That itself is a level of greatness. There's very few people, in my opinion, that truly rejoice for somebody else's happiness. It's a very high level. I know that most people deny it. They try and act, you know, when they're friends. But you think it out very carefully. It's interesting to notice people's true attitude towards what happens to other people that they're friendly with. Now, of course, if your friend calls you up, something good happened to me on the job, I got a raise. Oh, terrific, I'm so happy. Now, it depends. See, in a certain level of good things, you sort of rejoice with them. But if you notice, he's a very good observer of yourself, and you're very honest, there might be a twinge of sort of like, not so happy. A little jealousy, envy. But when something tremendously good happens to the other person, then I don't know that you're that happy. If something that, in other words, if it's usually something that doesn't take them out of your range, it's something that, you know, more or less could happen to you, whatever it is, I mean, it's nothing. Not that they've gotten something really special that you don't have. But if something tremendous, you know, like they met somebody and this person is wild about them and gave this tremendous car, or something really tremendous, then I don't know how the person, I mean, you have no choice but to say that you're thrilled, but inwardly there's going to be mixed feelings. There's going to be mixed feelings. Well, of course. I'm talking about the honest person. I'm not talking about a perfected. Now, why should it be? Why should it be? Normally, you say, this is my friend. And I'm happy that good things happen to my friend. Uh-huh. But you must, from this we must conclude that there's a certain amount of envy as well. Because every friend is a friend, but also a potential enemy. Because every friend is also a competitor. A competitor for somebody's love. Whose love? The love of God. In other words, we're talking about sibling rivalry. In other words, an imperfected person does view each and every other person. I mean, certainly foes, certainly strangers. That's why for a stranger you have no concern whatsoever, basically. There's no concern for the stranger. But the, right, 100%. But even for someone who's a friend, that person is also a potential competitor. Why is it? Because of each person's self-love. Each person, on a certain psychological level, wants to be the favorite of God. And wants good fortune. That's why people complain about the mail they get. Because why is it people love to get mail? They run through the mailman comes in front. Right? And why is it that people get very upset if they miss a phone call? Not everybody, some people are still. But generally speaking, there is that phenomenon. Like you hit a phone ring, you run, you drop everything, you get the phone. Right? And, or like if you're in the bathroom and you're showering, you hear the phone, you'll stop, you'll go, you get really crazy. Why is it so important when 99% of the phone calls you get are right? Because there's a certain fantasy that's the phone, that my ship is coming in. Each person is waiting, and not consciously, there's a certain part of the psyche that's waiting for their ship to come in, which means to say that they have this fantasy that a child of fantasy that they are very special and the whole world was created just for them, and that great good fortune is going to happen just to them. Now therefore, when it happens to somebody else, they get a little bit upset. That goes against the plan. If something tremendous happens and somebody else gets it, then that means that they're the chosen one, and it takes away from their own self-love. That's right. It went to somebody else, not to me. I'm not the favorite. It's a blow to me on the emotional level. Now, therefore, the converse of this, now I'm not saying that everybody partakes of this to the same degree. I would say that, I can't say that every individual, every person, but knowing human nature, it would seem to me that it's almost inevitable that these emotions are there. I mean, of course, we can perfect ourselves and rise above these emotions. On the other hand, it seems to me that one of the really truly great joys in life, and I know that it's hard to accept this, people are not going to want to accept hearing this, but I believe that one of the greatest enjoyments that people have, generally speaking, is somebody else's sorrow, somebody else's suffering. Somebody else's suffering are really a source of joy. Well, you have to, first of all, when you see that's true, you have to not isolate. Because when it's too close and a friend or whatever it is, so there's a lot of guilt involved too. You can't allow yourself. But when something bad happens to another person, even though you express sadness and all, do you feel total sadness, or does a certain part of you feel it's not so bad? In other words, because this sort of, in a crazy kind of a way, it's not a rational thing, but it sort of vindicates the thing happened to me. Exactly. Well, that's why the gossip and reading about Leona Helmsley and this and that, there where why don't people feel guilty? You know, there's people who normally would feel terrible if they didn't demonstrate sympathy for somebody else's plight. Right? Do gooders and so forth. Oh, but with Leona Helmsley, people are enjoy luxuriating in her downfall. Listen, but why is that permitted? Oh, because since she's wealthy, so therefore she's already gotten her share, etc. Now we have a right to be thrilled about the fact. People are thrilled. Why was it? I mentioned that point. The irony was that the difference in public reaction between Leona Helmsley and Gotti went scot-free. Right? There's no outcry whatsoever. In fact, he was welcomed home in his neighborhood. He's like a hero. Leona Helmsley got a very severe kind of a punishment, but it's not just that, but the public involvement, people were saying they should do more to her. that they should make her clean the toilets and everything. It's not enough for her. And had she gotten off free, there would have been an outcry like you couldn't imagine. Now, let's face it, in reality, how can you compare the two? She's basically, I mean, you can't compare her to a Gadi. She's someone, see, I mean, I hope that she was really, given what the normal procedures are today, that she was unjustly punished. I mean, she paid tremendous amounts of tax, all right, she cheated on some tax, so they could have charged her, they could have made a settlement, this and that, they didn't have to, it's excessive, there's no question it's excessive. Murderers don't get put away for that long. Murderers, rape, serial, I mean, rapists get off. So, and she's a constructive citizen in general, all right, so she cheated her a little bit. In today's society, it's hardly... But Agati, who was destroying society with crime, with drugs, and everything goes off scot-free. But, okay, that shows you how sick the system is. But people don't get upset about that. With her, everybody was riled up.
How would they feel that people can identify with she raised when she was with Agati,
that mafia, the whole secretive type of an organization that you have to know the question. That's basically the way I answered the question. I raised the question to Yeshiva, the same thing, is that people did not get all upset and worked up over the Helmsley because of their love of justice. Because if it's a matter of justice, then Gadi is a greater injustice. It's because of envy. They all envy her, because that's what they would like to be. So therefore they have tremendous hatred for her. She's this queen and this and that, and she has everything. So that's why there's a tremendous love. They felt fantastic that this gives them back a certain feeling of their own importance. That she's not the one. Look what happened to Shirai. That they're not there. She makes the average person feel like a nothing. So there's a tremendous hatred. Yeah, justification. Whereas with Gadi, he's a criminal. So nobody identifies with him. Nobody knows him. So therefore they didn't get angry. But the idea, you should recognize one thing though, is that I believe that there is a certain element of enjoyment in somebody else's suffering, which may not come to the fore. That's why the phenomenon of rubbernecking. That's why when there's a crash and everything, people have to see it. Now, why must they see it? Because they'll express how terrible and how tragic it is. So on the psychological level, there's a certain amount of enjoyment. It didn't happen to me. So their own sense of being God's chosen has been... When somebody else goes down, it makes you feel that's wrong. I'm not saying this is right, but I'm just showing the psychology. Now, the greatness that before we forget, as the Torah points out, just shows greatness, that he was happy. He lived on an object of flame, that something good befell the Jews, even though it was the Jews. And I'll tell you, of all people, nobody is happy when something good happens to the Jews. Right? The world can't take that something good happens to the Jews, because they're the ones that are the most envied of all. Because they are chosen by God. And if the world did not believe that they were chosen, then they wouldn't be envious. When you're envious of someone, it means that you... In other words, if you're envious of someone, and then you say, well, he's not as good as he claims to be, and then you put him down, it's a contradiction in terms. Because if you truly believe that person's inferior, then you're not going to be envious of that person. You're only envious of someone who you, on a certain level, believe is superior. That's why Yisrael rejoiced, concern for all the good that God had done to Israel. That's why the word Israel is pointed out. That even though he didn't partake of that in any personal way, his reactions weren't based on personal, but on the object of good. So you see, it was on a very high level. Lord, listen to the next two verses. And Yisrael said, blessed is God who saved you from the hands of Egypt and from the hands of Paro, who saved the nation from under the hands of Egypt. Now, verse 11 is what I want to concentrate on. And that's basically the whole shiur for today, is this verse. Now I know that God is greater than all the gods, for in the matter that they had sinned against them. Now, there's two parts to this. First of all, what does it mean, now I know? What's the now I know? Let's concentrate on that first. Now, Rashi says, now I know means like this. I recognized him before, but now even more. That's the comment of Rashi. Now, what is difficult about that? Any question on that? Sure, Lord. In other words, how is that possible? Either, in other words, what he's saying is, I recognized God before. That means I believed in God before. Now I believe even more. I mean, either you recognize, either you believe in something, or you don't believe in something. All right. Either I acknowledge the existence of something or I don't. How could it be more or less? What is he telling us about Yisrael? You understand my point? Well, what do you mean it wasn't complete? So then he was. Then how can you say I recognized him before? Then you didn't recognize him before. You were in doubt before.
How?
You say that this story is questionable, whether this story occurs after the giving of the Torah at Sinai or before. Now, according to those who say that this occurs in its proper sequential order, this occurs before Mount Sinai, this meeting. So it can't be in reference to Mount Sinai. It's in reference to the miracle that took place. Good question. Would this statement be appropriate to say Abraham? Let's say it were Abraham Avinu.
No.
And Abraham came back. He was dead by this time, Abraham. Abraham came back to life. Let's say he was resurrected, came back to life. And what is so funny about that? We believe in resurrection of the dead. It's possible. What right now is this, is that one of the fundamentals of the Torah belief, that is to say, those beliefs that a person must have or else he's considered to be very deficient in his status as a Jew, and basically doesn't have a share in the world to come, is that there is a phenomenon of resurrection of the dead. That is to say, that there is a phenomenon of resurrection, which means to say that those who have died, I mean died, I don't mean like they have these cases where they think a person died and came back, they were dead for like 2 seconds. That's different. That means they never really died. But someone who's been dead, I mean, for thousands of years and then decomposed, God, since God is the creator, and God was able to create matter from nothing, God can bring back all the various molecules and so on and put them together again as physical human beings. Now, that will happen. According to the Rambam, however, his interpretation is that this will not occur to everybody. That in the days of the Messiah, this will happen to certain select individuals. Now, the belief that such a phenomenon will occur, although now what he's telling us is that that's all we know. God did not choose to reveal all the particulars.
He's not going to tell us
who it happened. Now we don't know who, nor do we know in what condition, what they'll look like, what they're wearing, and so on and so forth. Other than this, that same person, that exact same person, in physical and psychological form, will be returned to Earth. Of course, in his view, it's basically that they'll be needed to perform certain historical missions, and then they will die, they'll live normally, like, you know, they'll die, and their soul, my mind is held that the ultimate reward is the eternal life of the soul apart from the body. Okay. Now, with the phenomenon that there will be a resurrection of the dead in the days of the Messiah, that is a fundamental Jewish belief. Others, by the way, the Ramban, Nachmanides, another great commentator and thinker, a philosopher, held that this will occur to all the righteous. That the ultimate, that's another argument, whether the ultimate reward of the righteous is in the spiritual realm, purely the existence of the soul without the body, or in a physical existence. And therefore, Nachmanides' view was that in the days of the Messiah, all the righteous who will live eternally will be resurrected and they'll live on this world eternally. Physically. That's a good question. Let's say then that Abraham had been resurrected at that time and had been told. Would he have the same response? Now I know that God is greater.
No.
Why not? That's the key difference. Why not?
Because he has final knowledge.
Yes. In other words, like this. If a person's conviction is based on knowledge, then it's not subject to increase. Because either you know or you don't know. Now that's the famous story about Einstein with the eclipse. That he had predicted a certain eclipse based on his calculations. So on that day when it was supposed to occur, everybody was gathered, waiting for the eclipse. And Einstein was not anywhere, you know, near it. He was just going about his normal routine. So they said, well, aren't you out there? Don't you want to see it? Aren't you curious to see it? He said, no, I know it's going to happen. There's no point in my... One second. Which means to say that curiosity stems from a lack of belief. It means you're not convinced. And that's what, by the way, that's what they say about Noach. That he entered the... Yeah, that he was Mamin and Eino Mamin. It says he entered the ark, from before the waters of the flood. That means that until the first few drops hit him, he didn't get on the boat. So he knew, he had conviction, but it was not complete. It required physical. Now, for most people, they don't live on the basis of their knowledge. They try it to a certain extent, but they want... No, no.
proof.
Exactly. Most people have the battle. The basic battle people have to confront in life is what if they operate on the basis of knowledge, the mind, or on the basis of sense perception. And unfortunately, people make the mistake in following their sense perception and not what their mind tells them. And that's why they live their life. They follow the crowd. They follow what's in. What seems to be correct according to their sense perception, not listening to the words of wisdom, which very often go against sense perception. The ways of wisdom are different than the way of sense perception, what seems to be right. But most people, seeing is believing. And Judaism holds that seeing is not belief. I mean, seeing is certain, of course, you have to have phenomena, but the ultimate knowledge has to be based upon proof, rational proof. So, it shows us that even though Yisro was a great man, and he had conviction, it's not the highest level. Because a certain part of him was unconvinced until he actually had a physical, he needed a certain physical manifestation of God. Abraham, in other words, the person, the true intellectual, doesn't need miracles. Nature itself is the greatest miracle. Abraham discovered God from the world of reality. He saw the tremendous wisdom that was implanted in nature. And from that he came to the conclusion that there must be a creator. Once he came to that conclusion, there was nothing. He didn't need any further proof. He didn't need any miracles. A miracle wouldn't add anything to it. That's like Einstein. I don't have to see it. I know it has to happen. I know it has to happen. It'd be the same thing. Now, if you tell me that that's not the case, like by Einstein, you shrugged it off. If like with your kid. If your kid, the oven is on at full blast, and your kid takes a thing of butter and puts it in the oven, you tell him that it's going to melt. And he says, no, he argues with you, it's not going to melt. Right? You're saying, no, I know it's going to melt, take it out. You say, no, let's wait and see. And you'll say, there's no need for me to wait and see because I know it has to melt. So you'll say that there's, right? Ah, now how come one, you say the same thing about Einstein? Because for you, the knowledge that heat will cause butter to melt, you're convinced, 100%, you're convinced about that. Therefore, there's no need for you to actually see. Why don't you listen to your kid? Why don't you listen to your kid? What's the difference how you've gotten the knowledge? It doesn't matter because let's say you've never seen butter melt. Let's say you see other stuff. You know that butter will be the same way. You've made deduction. That doesn't matter. It doesn't matter though. You know what? He's with some experience. He did calculations. His conclusion. It's not necessary. But you're missing the point. If he calculates how the sun. If he calculates, he knows that the sun has to travel, and he knows the moon, and he knows at a certain point one is going to cover the other, he doesn't have to go out there and see it. He knows it's going to happen. His knowledge tells him. I'm sorry? His knowledge tells him. He has not to experience his work. I don't know. I do not know. What's the difference? I don't understand why it's necessary. Let's say he's the first person. Let's say no, it never happened before. If he does calculations and they lead to a certain conclusion, he's 100% certain he's lost the curve. It's like a person that calculates a train. He calculates the speed of a train leaving from the Denver. The other one is leaving at that. He calculates that the crash must occur at that point. He doesn't have to. If that person is convinced of his proofs, on the basis of his proofs, he doesn't have to be there to see it. He knows it must happen.
He came up with his theory in 1906.
In other words, he needed the support. It wasn't totally. He wasn't an individual. He was not an individual that had complete reliance. His conviction was not completely rooted in his knowledge. He was lacking others. To a certain extent, he was affected by the sensual, by what he saw. He needed support. He needed a physical proof. So therefore, when this phenomenon occurred, it increased his conviction. That, I'm saying, is a criticism of his conviction. It's not the highest level of conviction. Now, the next part, let's take a look at the next part. It says, now I know that God is greater than all the gods. Now, what's difficult about that? That statement itself does not make any sense. What's the problem with that statement? Yeah, it's a contradiction in terms. If he has a true conviction, if he's a monotheist, then that means to say he does not believe in any other gods. Of course, that's the fundamental of Judaism, that God is one. There are no other gods. Now, if we're praising Yisro as a monotheist, then what is the meaning of the statement that God is greater than all the gods? There are no other gods. Now, Rashi says like this, that the that it's trying to teach us an idea. And he says like this, from all the gods, it comes to teach us that he knew all the idols in the world. He recognized all the idols in the world. That he didn't leave one idol, he did not leave one idol that he didn't worship. Which means to say that in his career, he had that he had done all the religions and he worshipped all the idols. And that's what he means. Now my question is, what is the point of Rashi? What is the point of telling us? What is the underlying idea over here? I mean, are they trying to praise him? Are they trying? It sounds like a criticism. That he wasn't a, it was like a put down. Here we're trying to praise the whole sense of the verse is to praise him as a great individual, and it was like a little dig. Now I know that God is greater than all the gods. I mean, to say that we see from this that he had worshipped every idol in the world, there was not one idol that he hadn't worshipped. What is the point of that? What is Rashi trying to communicate to us? And usually, if you want an approach to Rashi, when Rashi makes a comment and doesn't make, it's based on a question. There's not your the debate. It's based on an underlying question. I'm sorry. Yeah. What is it based on? What's the question? All right. I think you're on the right track. I think that Rashi is bothered by a subtle question, and the question is like this: that what prompted Yisro to come to Moses? Tremendous events had occurred. I mean, even though they didn't have the media and the communication they have today, but the word got out. It was known. The Jews were enslaved by the mighty, Egypt at that time was the mightiest empire on earth, and Egypt had been totally decimated by the 10th plague. The Jews had escaped. The event at the crossing of the Red Sea where the entire Egyptian army had been destroyed, certainly the word got out. There's no question. We see later on, that's why Amalek came to attack them. So isn't it strange that only one individual was prompted to come forward and inquire and investigate and find out what's behind this phenomenon? Isn't that strange? No, but if this, wouldn't there be other people in the world that would be interested, that would want to know what happened, how is it possible? I'm sorry? How come nobody converted? No, but they were involved, they were part of the Jewish people. Why is it only one person came forward? Why only one person from the outside world? These were intended, the miracles of God were intended for the benefit of the entire world, not just for the Jews. So what's the answer? I think Rashi is trying to give us the answer. What does it mean? See, what does it mean when it tells us that he worshipped every... Well, first of all, maybe to your point, it could have just simply said he was an idol worshiper. But it goes beyond that and says there wasn't one idol in the whole world that he hadn't worshipped. That's more than just. Let me see if I can illustrate the idea.
Maybe they.
I want to get
it. Almost like an astrology type of thing, where everything had a God, but there was one. In other words, it was a monotheistic world, where different things were attributed to different gods.
Right.
So now,
there's an interesting statement. Yeah, but even worship, that's a little bit different, slightly different. I think there's a very important lesson idea about the nature of man in general. Now it says in Yeshaya says, Hoy kol tameh l'chula mayim, let everyone who is thirsty come to the water. Now that the Torah there is a euphemism of the water, rather, is a euphemism for Torah. He's calling people to come to the water of Torah, knowledge. Okay? Now in many places the Torah is compared to water. The Torah is compared to water. Now the question that I asked on this is, it seems to me strange that the Torah should be compared to water, because water is the most common, unexotic, or unexquisite, which is not a word, object in the world. In other words, for example, you can't, when you recite the Kiddush on Friday night, you have to use wine or grape juice, or if you can't have that, then you have to use something, some drink that has some importance that you would serve on a special occasion, like whiskey and a highball type of thing. Even beer would be acceptable. At the even, and worst comes to worst, you could use coffee, because coffee, people don't drink coffee. Instead, the Torah is compared to water.
The basis of life.
The basis of life, okay, that's one idea. And it's readily accessible. There's a lot of ideas, true. But I was thinking of something else. Anybody else besides that? The Rambam says it goes from above to below. Below, so it only comes to those who are humble. A haughty person can't gain knowledge. That's one of the lessons. A haughty person can't gain knowledge because he's too egotistical to learn. He thinks he knows. He assumes he knows everything. But I was thinking of another. What you're saying is correct.
So for the first thing that you don't have, that
your most primary need, right? Water is more important
than food.
A person can live without food. Right? I was thinking of like this, though. I have a totally different interpretation, which I think that you might find interesting. I think it teaches us something fundamental. Now, there's the interesting characteristic about water. A person... Do people value water or don't they value water?
Of course.
See, one's attitude towards water depends upon its state. When a person is thirsty, then what does he want? Does he want soda? Don't tell me about your kids. Now, when a person has a real workout or in the summer. I remember reading the story in The Revolt by Menachem Begin. He talks about the years in the underground when they fought for independence from the British. So there was a big price on his head. So he had different disguises. He went to different disguises. In one case, he was disguised as a Hasidic Rebbe. And he lived in this house, I forget the name of his town, and he had built a special attic, with a door, with a trap, whatever it is, in case he had to hide out. So one time the British did a sweep of the city, and they actually camped out on his front yard. That's where they made their headquarters. And they did a whole sweep. They locked off the city. So he had to go into that hiding place. Now, the situation was so dangerous that his wife could not talk to him because they were right outside. The British could come in the house at any moment. They were coming in and out. They were using the house like a headquarters. And they didn't suspect that Menachem Begin, that was their prize, suspects they were looking for, they would kill them. She was there, yeah, but they didn't know she was.
They
didn't know she was. So, she could not talk to him or get him any food or water. Even at night, it was too dangerous. So he said that he was there, I think, three or four days until they finally left the town and he was able to come out. And he said he didn't care about food or anything, but what was doing was he was dying of thirst. And when he got out of there, he didn't want any food. His wife had to fill up a whole bathtub. He described it. He filled up a bathtub with water, and he just like plunged into it and was like, he couldn't get enough water. So you see that the attitude towards water depends upon the state of the person. When a person is thirsty, then there's nothing better than water. When a person is not thirsty, then they're not interested in water at all. They have no interest in water. Now that's what it's trying to tell us about Torah. Now what determines a person's attitude towards Torah? It depends upon this. That, see, Judaism posits that just like there's a physical thirst in a person, so too there's an innate spiritual thirst for knowledge in a person. That's innate in man. And this is all, the Rambam quotes this pasuk, Sama Nafshi Lelokim, my soul thirsts for the Lord. Now, that is something, since God designed man, and the purpose, by endowing man with reason, with a soul, the purpose is so that man should obtain knowledge, and ultimately knowledge has to be knowledge of God. That's the ultimate expression, the ultimate result of all knowledge is to have knowledge of God. So therefore, God implanted within man the desire for knowledge. And you see, children have a natural desire to learn. Of course, as soon as they go to the schools, it's destroyed. When they encounter adults and they express their curiosity, it's destroyed. School, the greatest enemy of knowledge is the school system.
They have an innate, yeah.
Instead of building upon this and satisfying it, they destroy it. Because they then make it extremely painful. They have to memorize, they have to take tests, and they put them down. And if a kid asks, you see, kids start to ask questions. Why is it this way? Why is it that way? They get annoyed with these questions because they don't know the answers. They make the kid feel very bad about it, and they repress the natural... And therefore, when a person becomes an adult, and they associate... And I know a lot of their actual really problem in the yeshiva, because after we give them, we show them a different side of the Torah and they really enjoy the learning, but they still haven't, they can't sit and learn for too long because they still have this childhood in the unconscious, this childhood association of learning and pain, so that their natural desire is not to learn. When they think about learning, it's a painful thing. Now the real, this is the proper state of a person, the state of perfection, is when he's in a state where he's thirsting for God. Shaman Nafshi Elokim, to be in that state, that he's thirsting for knowledge, is the proper state for a person to be in. And if a person is not in that state, then they're lacking something in terms of their perception of human beings. Now, of course, to the extent each person is different. Some people are always, there's different levels. But one must know that life cannot be, in other words, an outside to-do, today, too, I wanted to say to-do and today, so I said to-do. Okay. It is. Anyways, our society also, you see, there's another problem too, in that I think Linda can relate to this, that there's a natural hunger, that people have a desire for nutrition, but this can be destroyed by junk food. The idea is that people claim that they can't enjoy these foods, natural foods, without all this, frying and all this junk. And of course, nutritionists will maintain that no, that the person in the natural state can enjoy these foods, but their appetite has been corrupted by junk food, and they become addicted to junk. The same is true. A person has a need. People have a need to know and an enjoyment of knowledge. You see this, by the way, that people get excited like at a Scrabble or these quiz programs, they figure out an answer, right? So you see, people do enjoy to a certain extent when they gain the gaining of knowledge, but unfortunately it's been perverted with junk food. The society satiates the person, right? Instead of thinking about an issue, they have to listen to it. The most amazing thing is that you watch talk shows. Now, people watch talk shows and then say, what is it? You're watching two other people. They're not, I can understand if a genius, right? You're listening to real thinkers. But, right. The biggest idiots in the world, or the Johnny Conner show, talking about stupidity, talking about trivia, and people are entertained by this. I mean, wouldn't you rather sit down with an intelligent person and engage in an intelligent discussion about an idea? That's entertainment. But the thing is that it's vital that a person realize, if a person is living his life and does not have within him this need to know, the need for knowledge, then he's lacking a essential component of human existence. Now, what the Pasuk is talking about, the greatness of Yisro, why was Yisro different? Why did Yisro of all people come forward to find out? Because he worshipped every idol. The worshipping of every idol teaches you, and he didn't leave one idol, he went from one system, he studied every available system, which means that he had a need to know. He was thirsting for knowledge. Since he had a desire for the truth, if a person, in my opinion, a person that does not have a desire for the truth is not truly human. And that's something I can never really relate to or understand. I really can't. I still to this day can't. I categorize people. I see, there are certain people that are involved in studying and gaining knowledge. They want the truth. And then, when you give them an idea, they get all excited. Then there are the overwhelming majority of people could care less. Could care less. You tell them, you explain an idea and you're all excited about this and that. No good. Yeah, which means that I can't believe it. That how can this person be human? Because I'm human, they're human. And for me, the idea gets me excited. I get excited. I remember when I first, heard the idea of the philosophy and that made sense to me and so forth, and the excitement that I was the one originally who mentioned the Rabbi Chaitin, which is not about yeshiva, because he was very reluctant. He thought that people wouldn't be interested. I was the one that I couldn't believe. I can't say that people will hear these ideas and not get excited. And yet you find that, they can care less. They may listen, they may not listen, but they certainly won't get it. They can't. Now, that's something I always had a difficulty relating to. How could a person be human and not need to know? I remember, what I didn't know, whatever I know now, but when I had no knowledge at all, and I was a teenager, and I was searching for answers, I knew that somewhere there had to be some answers, but I felt in pain, not knowing what the truth is. That's the point about Yisrael over here. That the greatness of Yisrael was because... No. What it means to say... No. So what it means to say is that he tried out every system. You have to look at it philosophically. He kicked out every system. Nobody abandoned it. If it was a pure... If it was just an emotional thing... If it was just an emotional thing, then he would have been satisfied emotionally with one religion or another. Can't do that. But it means that he was searching intellectually. So wherever he heard about a system, he checked it out. But once he saw that it didn't make sense, he gave it up. He was searching for the truth. That's why when the real manifestation of God became available, he clung to it, because he was in that state that he was looking for the truth.
But why is it different than Abraham?
It is true, as Lori points out about Abraham, that he too, it says he was raised as an idolater, but from earliest youth, from the time he was 3, that's a perfect illustration, by the way, of an individual whose natural need to know. Because from the time he was 3 years old, he was a genius, he was brilliant, but he started questioning by day and by night. He couldn't stop questioning. And that's what carried him through. It wasn't stifled. Nobody could stifle his need to know, so he kept studying, and he was worshipping, because that's the way he was raised, and studying, and thinking, and thinking, and studying, until he reached the firm basis, until he saw what was going on, and he was able to work his way through, and to perfect himself, and operate in accordance with the true ideas. So that's a classical case, a greater example of an individual, because here's an individual who was raised in a world which is totally corrupt, which did not have any ideas at all, purely on his own, and based upon his innate need to know, his desire for knowledge, and his great mind. The average, you have to have a great mind, he was able to rediscover the true ideas. It's not that, what do you mean? In what sense? It's the same thing. I don't know why the difference is that they partook of the same quality. But Yisro could not achieve on his own what Avram did. Because you see that he did not achieve that level of freeing, right, without Moshe. And also without the miracles. Avram did not need miracles, and Yisro did. So Yisro was not as great an individual. But with regard to the idea, the role, I think it's a very important thing. That's why he says, let everyone who is thirsty come to the Torah. Because if you're not thirsty, then Torah means nothing to you. The Torah is the greatest good. The Torah is the greatest system, but only for a person who is thirsty, who has a need to know. His need for knowledge is a vital element of his existence. Cannot exist without knowledge. So there are two kinds of people in this world. There are those who can exist without knowledge, and those who cannot exist. In reality, nobody can exist, because that's not true existence. But in terms of their own personal feeling, there are many people who like to care less about knowledge. They devalue it. So the Torah is meaningless to them. Even religious people. But, as I said again, that is something that a person should examine himself. Because if you found suddenly that you had no appetite, for food, you'd realize there's something wrong with you. Because it's only natural and normal that a person should have an appetite for food. Not that I'm worried that this will happen to anybody. But one should think about it that way. But somehow, when it comes to the soul, if one doesn't sense a desire for knowledge, and one is content to go for days and weeks without learning, or without knowledge, it's not a part of their life, you don't feel that maybe there's something wrong with me, and maybe I should get myself over to the doctor of the soul. Okay.